Thanks. Okay, well, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thanks to the organisers for the opportunity to talk. I mean, since this is a discussion session, I mean, I think people should be free to interject at any point, as usual, and add any comments, any references, any important things that they think are actually coming out of the ADS-CFT side, and equally on the condensed matter side, if people have particular views or strong opinions on various things, just pipe up, okay? So this is some ongoing work in collaboration with Julian Sonner and Toby Wiseman and Jerome Gortlet and also Ben Simons, trying to look at problems that are somehow fertile from both a condensed matter point of view and an ADS point of view. Okay, and since this is, you know, largely the scope of this workshop, I think it's fair enough to kind of discuss this in a discussion type format. And so just to give a little bit of an overview of where I'm heading, I'll start out with some background motivation to the equilibrium problem, which I think it's important for a general condensed matter audience to try and point out. So I think one of the things that a condensed matter physicist who's not been working in ADS-CFT will naturally ask themselves is, why should I be interested in these ADS models as models for experiment, and even more than experiment, even just related to simple models that they're looking at in the lab? And so I'll try and just give a brief review of some developments just to kind of really try and make that crystal clear. And I think for me, what's very striking about this ADS-CFT correspondence is it's very naturally designed to look at non-equilibrium problems. And many of these problems are rather difficult to look at in condensed matter physics, and people are trying to think of simple models, usually in 1+1 dimensions or in integrable cases, where they can deal with tractable examples of non-equilibrium dynamics. And I think ADS-CFT might be particularly well suited for this kind of question. Now, obviously, just with the time available, it's a bit difficult to kind of survey all of these various issues. And so I'm going to use one primary example in relation to this so-called BC-BCS crossover. This has been a subject of a lot of interest in the last few years in relation to ultra-cold atoms experiments. And there's also natural connections to people looking at holographic superconductors that you can start to ask condensed matter type questions about these strongly coupled systems. And so in particular, I'm going to look at quench dynamics in this holographic setup. And as I said, this is very much work in progress. The numerics are only just kind of coming to fruition. So Toby Wiseman's working on trying to solve the coupled Einstein equations you get from this. And so it's going to be a little while before I think all of this comes together. But nonetheless, I can hopefully give you some kind of overview of the spirit of where we're trying to head and what the rationale is. And I think another thing that's worth pointing out, as I mentioned before, I mean, a lot of the examples that people are using in condensed matter physics are integrable models. And very often you're worried about what is the role of integrability in the answers that you're getting. Okay? And paradoxically, it could well be that some of the ADS-CFT examples, particularly in higher dimensions, might be sufficiently general from the perspective of interactions and equilibration that maybe you can circumvent some of these issues. Okay? And so I'll just round off with a kind of current status and where we're trying to head. So my own interest in this came in relation to high-temperature superconductors. I don't really want to get bogged down in the nitty-gritty of high-TC. It's not really relevant for what I want to say. But in terms of trying to communicate why ADS-CFT is important for a condensed matter audience, I think this is actually a useful starting point. And so the Nernst effect is basically like a thermal analog of the Hall effect. You're asking what is the transverse voltage that's generated in some sample if you apply a temperature gradient in a transverse magnetic field. And so the Nernst coefficient is usually written in this way, that it's this electric field divided by the temperature gradient normalized by the magnetic field. So this is an open circuit experiment. You're just measuring a voltage, not charge transport. But if you place open boundary conditions on the current gradient relationship, you can recast this expression in terms of elementary transport coefficients. And so this is really where ADS-CFT and hydrodynamics and various things start to play a role, because you can recast this problem as asking the question about transport properties in strongly coupled systems. And the main point is that this is a cartoon of a high temperature superconductor, so you have some antiferromagnets at low doping, you go to this superconducting dome, and the basic point is that this Nernst effect is enhanced above this superconducting state. So this is the experimental data that really started to catalyze all this of Huanong. Actually, the experimental data that catalyzed it was on the previous transparency. This is some follow-up data. And the basic point, though, is that this signal exists above TC. Okay, so it's telling you that some precursors of superconductivity are actually important here in order to get this appreciable response. And one way that people have tried to think about such things is that maybe in this regime you don't have a superconductor, but to have a superconductor you need an amplitude and a phase. So perhaps one way to think about this is that you have an amplitude that's formed, but you've got very large phase fluctuations that are disordering your superconductivity, so you don't have superconductivity, but nonetheless you've got this wide fluctuating regime above TC. Okay. So the natural question then is, how do you start to understand the impact of fluctuations on the general magnetothermoelectric response in these systems? And so what we started to do was just to say, okay, look, I mean, high TC is pretty complicated. Let's try and ask this question in a very simple setting. And what we did was to look at the superfluid Mott insulator transition in this so-called Bose-Hubbard model. Okay, and so the Bose-Hubbard model was introduced by Fisher and company quite a while ago. And in fact, even though it's a model of bosons, it actually arose in connection with thinking about superconducting thin films, where you imagine trying to build up a superconducting film by putting little puddles of metal down. As you make this film thicker, it eventually goes superconducting. So you're imagining that bosons or Cooper pairs can hop between these puddles, and you're asking, is there a transition from some insulating state to some superfluid? And the basic point is that, you know, as usual, you can ask about field theories of various transitions. And in the tip of this so-called Mott lobe, so here you have a pin density of either one boson, two bosons per site. At the tip of this Mott lobe, it's known that the transition is in the universality class of this XY model. Okay, so something that you're very used to seeing in standard books on quantum field theory. But most of the examples that you see when you look at standard quantum field theory textbooks, people are computing things like critical indices. They're computing things within the epsilon expansion for the Wilson-Fisher fixed points. And one of the more interesting questions in relation to these superconductor insulator transitions, though, is transport. Okay? And so this was, I think, first most clearly discussed by Subir and his graduate students at the time, Keller Daimler, by trying to reformulate this problem as a quantum Boltzmann equation. Okay? So basically, you're asking about this response close to this critical point. Things behave as a function of omega over T. The only scale in your problem is temperature. And so one of Subir's main points was that because of this non-trivial functional dependence as a function of omega over T, you have to set the problem up in such a way that you can access clearly the hydrodynamic regime when frequencies are very small in order to get the DC conductivity. And so one of the nice features about that approach was that it was a real-time approach to transport. So you don't have to go from Euclidean space and analytically continue back and worry about whether or not there's any subtleties in deriving the answers. That's actually a feature that's also shared by these ADS-CFT techniques. It's a rather different formulation, but the basic point is still there. And I think that's absolutely crucial going forward in terms of trying to extend these to non-equilibrium problems. And so the basic result then was that you can derive these beautiful results for the electrical conductivity, and for a two-dimensional sample, you get this universal result that it's a multiple of E squared upon H. And for a long time, people hadn't looked at more general transport properties in the system. I think primarily because there were some unpublished results that the thermal conductivity in this clean Bose-Hubbard model is infinite. Okay, and that's just basically because particle and hole type excitations both move in the same direction, and the energy current is conserved, and so you get a formally infinite response. Okay, but in the presence of a magnetic field, this isn't the case. And what we demonstrated was that you can see that there's non-trivial thermoelectric response. Very crudely speaking, you've got some transverse drifting E cross B fields. And so this is some transport of entropy density or heat in the transverse direction as a result of having a problem with both electric and magnetic fields. Okay. And similarly, we also demonstrated that associated with this generic setup, there's also a finite thermal conductivity in a magnetic field. Okay? And one thing that you see is that these results are reciprocally related in the epsilon expansion. Okay? And then along comes this beautiful paper by Sue Beer and Sean Hartnell and Marcus and Pavel, looking at this problem from a completely different perspective. I mean, looking at this from the perspective of both relativistic hydrodynamics and also explicit computations done in supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory. Okay? And what they demonstrated, amongst many other things, was that, in fact, these coefficients are actually exactly related by this duality relation, namely that the thermal conductivity in a magnetic field turns out to be exactly reciprocally related to this DC conductivity. And if you just look at this computation within the epsilon expansion, I mean, it's a bit of a leap to kind of go the whole hog to say that this is actually exactly related inversely to the conductivity. They have the reciprocal dependence in the epsilon expansion. And in fact, this...
The D plus 3 is bothering me.
Sorry? The D plus 3?
Yeah. Where? The T to the D plus 3. Is that...
I'll have to double check it, but I mean, it's dimensional analysis, so it
should... But it doesn't give you the T here.
No, but then I got rid of the conductivity,
right? So... Probably
3 minus E. It might be 3 minus E. I'll have to double check it again. But it's fine. But okay, but you see, the basic point is that all of these results are... you know, consistent with dimensional analysis. You have to do some legwork to do an explicit computation in the epsilon expansion. And in fact, actually, the original result that we published in this letter was actually just some leading term, in a sense, just to demonstrate that there is some longitudinal shift. And actually, after this result was published, you say, well, look, I mean, it's completely impalatable if this is an exact duality, that doing an epsilon expansion, you could possibly get a coefficient that wasn't exactly unity. And it turns out that it's a little bit subtle, because although you're doing an epsilon expansion and there's a small parameter in the game, in order to get into the hydrodynamic regime, omega has to be much, much less than epsilon in some prescribed sense. And so you have to be very careful to extract this dimensionless prefactor, and it changes by just a few percent. But that's enough to mask the duality relation. And so we worked very hard following some very nice work of Marcus and collaborators in graphene. And you can see that actually this exact duality relation drops out of the epsilon expansion as well. And so the reason why I think this is an important story is because you see that the results that come out of these supersymmetric theories by very strange techniques for condensed matter physicists actually have direct bearing on rather standard models in condensed matter physics. And it's separate from the issue as to whether or not those models apply to the experiment, but it's actually very clearly enshrined that there's actually something deep in these approaches. And in this particular case, it was abridged by hydrodynamics. Okay. And so for me, at least, this is the kind of spirit that I would like to go forward in, is asking, what kind of problems can you look at where somehow you get at universal results, things that are somehow independent of the fact that you're starting from supersymmetric gauge theory, and you're trying to find something that has a broader validity?
Perhaps this is a while ago, and there's a lot myself in the meantime. So there's a membrane paradigm, right? Basically saying that there's all kind of universal results about hydrodynamics can be obtained from AUCFT. Is this really an exact duality? I seem to remember that there was a caveat that you needed extrapolations.
I'm not sure. Maybe Sue Beer is the best person to ask. I mean, in the ADS example, I mean, this drops out of the hydrodynamic regime exactly for the Boltzmann equation.
Eventually,
for Bose-Hubbard.
Right, so. Exactly prove this using hydrodynamics, but we only first saw it using supersymmetry. But this is Abel-Jouin relation, which is exact in all cases.
Yeah. Yeah, so you need supersymmetry to prove it, right?
That's precisely not my point. You can do it within the Boltzmann equation. You have to solve coupled integral equations. So the reason why it's a headache within the epsilon expansion is because you're trying to set up an honest epsilon expansion. So you've got to keep track of epsilon, you've got to keep track of all the dimensionless prefactors, and you have to solve integral equations. The Boltzmann collision term is some kind of integral over the momentum distributions of your particle. You wind up with miserable integral equations with horrible kernels, but you have to keep these unless you're going to make some approximations. For response in crossed electric and magnetic fields or temperature gradients, you have to keep track of both the longitudinal and the transverse response. And so you have to solve these equations appropriately. But it can be done, and it does drop out. And so it's precisely this point why I think the ADS approaches, which are from a very complementary perspective, actually offer real insight into other problems in condensed matter physics. And I think part of the main challenge for this kind of workshop is precisely to home in on what are the most interesting types of problems where you can tease out something of a broader validity. And I think in general that's rather hard, but okay.
Just get a second. So you assume that the membrane paradigm is right, that ADS-CFT is a black hole, gives you universal hydrodynamic relations, and then this duality is an example of that. And you don't need any extra assumptions.
You can certainly get it by our approach, but you can get it as Joe mentioned.
Exactly, and then you can check it directly by epsilon expression, you'll see your infections.
And I think basically, I mean, you know, here, I mean, I wouldn't say that I would prefer either method, right? I mean, the epsilon expansion is nice because you can do it close to a certain model, but it's a headache to do it, right? I mean, if you can get interesting broader results by other techniques, absolutely fine, right?
So I guess it is like better of the envelope computation and epsilon expansion is like, oh.
Well, here, I mean, I'm hiding the real monstrosity of these things, because actually they did all of the frequency dependence, added chemical potentials, added impurities. Now, in principle, you could do all of these things within the Boltzmann equation, but it would take 10 graduate students a long time, and actually, why would you bother if there's some better way of getting at things, right? So, okay. Okay, so what's the point then? So I apologize, you know, this is not going to be news to string theorists, but maybe if there's any condensed matter physicists in the audience. I mean, the basic thing I just want to stress actually is that this relationship between what happens on the boundary of ADS and these gravitational models in ADS space is enshrined in this Gubser, Plebanov, Polyakov, Witten formula. And basically, it's telling you that if you want to know the generating function of correlation functions on this boundary, you should look at the classical equations of motion in the interior of ADS. Okay, and there's a field boundary correspondence that says that fields living in ADS spacetime are related to operators in this boundary. This correspondence is not limited to purely static correlations or equilibrium correlation functions. And so in principle, you can use this mapping between these theories to look at time-dependent correlation functions. Okay? And in particular, what I just want to point out is that, you know, there's been a lot of work on looking at these problems in 1+1 dimension, as I mentioned. Now, I understand from talking to various people here and also at other meetings and also in Cambridge that, you know, gravity in three dimensions is special. So the mapping between ADS-3 and CFT-2 might be less interesting for certain purposes. Okay. On the other hand, for condensed matter physics, it might actually be very important to establish a closer dialogue between what is going on in condensed matter physics and ADS. And in particular, you have the option then of anchoring to results in 1+1 dimensions and then generalizing them to higher dimensions, where actually condensed matter physicists would actually have a harder time doing the computations. Okay? And just to give an illustration, I mean, the one type of problem that's cropping up quite a lot on the condensed matter side, and as I'll mention as well also on the ADS side, is quantum quench type problems where you start with some Hamiltonian with a parameter G and you abruptly change this coupling constant. And so what you're imagining is that you can also think about this, that you start your system in a state of the Hamiltonian with a parameter G, but it time evolves under a Hamiltonian with a different parameter, i.e. you're not starting the system in an eigenstate of this final Hamiltonian, and so it has some non-trivial time evolution. So, put differently, we're kicking these quantum systems, and in a sense, we're putting them in these highly excited states, And very crudely speaking, one thing that's kind of emerging in these 1 plus 1 dimensions is that effectively you get some emergent temperature. You've put some energy into your system, so your correlation functions know about some temperature. And this is very natural from an ABS perspective, because you're hitting this boundary theory and you're going to create a black hole in the interior of ABS, and your final dynamics is going to involve this this temperature state. And so I would say there's kind of, you know, there's been quite a lot of work on quantum quenches in condensed matter physics, and I'm not going to have time to summarize them here, but a couple of notable examples, primarily to try and bring relations to what's going on in ADS-CFT. There's very nice work by Cardi and Calabresi looking at what happens if you quench to a 1 plus 1 CFT, and you're asking questions about how do one-point functions and two-point functions evolve. There's also quantum quenches and integrable quantum spin chains, and here I'm just citing this just because it's the most recent work where actually some very nice results have been obtained, which I'll mention in a minute. But there's been quite a lot of work on this and various issues surrounding quenches in spin chains. And what I want to talk about here primarily is this quantum quench in the BCS pairing Hamiltonian. So with the advent of controllability of ultracold atoms, people started to think very seriously what happens if you start to change interaction parameters very quickly by sweeping the magnetic field, for example, if you're using Feshbach resonances. And so you start to ask questions that you couldn't ask easily in a condensed matter setting. Okay, so without quenching through the superconducting transition rapidly, you'd have no way to just turn on pairing instantaneously. Okay?
In this case, you get tunnelization.
Well, but I would say this is actually an open question, actually. So So first of all, in relation to Cardi and Calabresi, what I would say is that in relation to quenches to a quantum critical point, they see some exponential decay of the correlation function, so there is some emergent gap, let's call it that. Okay, whether you should call it thermalization or not is another story. Okay, so that was just one example.
It's some sort of relaxation, but it's not some.
Okay, so let me slow down. So the second thing is, so this is actually an important point, and actually I think maybe the ADS-CFT examples might be able to shed some light on this. Okay, so the second work, as I will point out, this is quantum quenches in an integrable spin chain in transverse field Ising, and I'll show it in a minute. And what they conclude is that the resulting correlation functions, essentially because you can fermionize this Ising model, it decouples into a bunch of discrete K modes, and each of those modes they claim has an effective temperature. So this is what they mean by a generalized Gibbs ensemble.
Okay.
However, there's a conjecture in that paper that appears in their specific case because they have diagonal scattering. So they conjecture that in an integrable model with non-diagonal scattering, this generalized Gibbs distribution will collapse to a thermal distribution, even in the integrable case. Okay? Whether or not it's true or not. And so again, you see, the issue is, how are these tied to integrability, right? So by generalized Gibbs, what they basically mean is that somehow, roughly speaking, Gibbs distribution, you have your e to the minus beta h factor. In an integrable system, you've got more than just the Hamiltonian as a commuting quantity. And so in principle, you could imagine all of these commuting currents in this exponent with Lagrange multipliers for each of them. So there's some notion that integrability may be special in terms of what types of distribution you get. And part of the reason they looked at this was to answer precisely such questions. Yeah?
I mean, if a system is integrable, then it's not ergodic. So in what sense is that thermalization?
Well, but again, these are kind of questions that people are asking. So I would say, actually, it's probably not useful to debate too strongly about whether it means thermalization in the sense that you would mean if it's some interacting system and it's exchanging energy and you have complete ergodicity. Okay. What I would say, it's a more practical question. If you do a quench in such an integrable system, you want to try and get a handle on what does the one-point function, what does the two-point function. And you're simply asking, is there any sense in which these quantities are governed by some effective temperature? Okay. And it's clear that there's somehow morally an effective temperature, just in the sense that you by construction, by kicking the system hard, you put some energy into the system. But whether or not you can talk about relaxation in the same way as you can in a kind of conventional non-integrable system is less clear. Okay, and so again, ADS-CFT may be very useful here, One issue I have, and actually may be very important to people working in this field, is the fact that, as I understand it, in these strongly coupled gauge theories, the thermalization rates are incredibly rapid. And so you might wonder whether or not they can tell you anything interesting about condensed matter problems from that point of view, okay? At least on short timescales, okay? On the other hand, they may be useful for telling you about the kind of final state of systems because they do equilibrate. Okay?
This is also a sort of a practical matter, so you create your strongly interacting condensed matter systems, something called Adams thermals at the unitary point or something. And then you should also see the same very rapid relaxation, I guess, that you get out of the CFT.
Well, so there are some experiments by David Weiss, so a lot of this was actually motivated also by colliding condensates. And there, there were questions as to whether or not they were seeing an absence of thermalization that they attributed to the fact that these models were close to integrability. So that's even a slightly different perspective. So there it was somehow their systems weren't equilibrating at all, rather than incredibly rapidly. Okay, but again, these are kind of interesting questions, and I would say that, you know, primarily it's hard to do this in a condensed matter setting, just simply because by construction, if you want to know about the long time asymptotics in a system, then you better have a pretty good handle on how you do the calculation in order to reliably extract the long time behavior. So just as I mentioned, so I will skip over these examples reasonably quickly, but it was just to point out that, you know, what they're saying is that if you do this quantum quench to a critical point, your time evolving under this conformal Hamiltonian, and very crudely speaking, your initial state acts like a boundary condition. So they're using tricks of boundary conformal field theory, or more generally boundary critical behavior, in order to work out the temporal dependence of the one-point function. And so they say, okay, this one-point function relaxes to zero in the long time limit, as you would expect in equilibrium. X here is not spatial dimensionality, but is the scaling dimension of the operator. And there's some non-universal decay, because the decay rate is essentially governed by the mass gap in the system you start with. So you start away from a critical point, you quench to a critical point. The time dependence of the correlation functions knows about this. But ratios of observables will exhibit exponential decay, will exhibit universal behavior, because these prefactors will drop out.
Yeah.
So this is done generically. So so the point is that in 1 plus 1D, you can do the calculation because you can do conformal transformation to finite strip geometry. And so John was using this trick to, and Pasquale, to solve the problem in Euclidean spacetime exactly and analytically continue back and cross-check against various models where they could do the computation. And so this is generic statements about what happens if you quench to an arbitrary critical point in 1 plus 1D. Okay? So from that sense, you know, 1 plus 1D problem is solved, right? On the other hand, if I ask you to do the computation in higher dimensions, I mean, it would be less clear where to start. Also, there'd been subsequent work by John Cardy and one of his graduate students trying to understand how you can treat quenches in interacting systems. And again, in ADS-CFT, you might have a chance to be able to look at such problems. Okay. And so,
curiosity.
Yeah.
So when you look at high-order correlation functions, you look at big operators, they're all given by the same effective temperature.
I think that's...
So you have 1 point, well, 2 point, houses, 4 point, 8 point.
So that's less clear, I think.
Okay.
So there may be there's probably a definitive answer that you can give.
But then there's a D6 might be sort of...
Well, so the reason I
hesitate...
Well, so let's slow down a bit. So the reason I hesitate is that if you just ask about equilibrium CFT, you know that the 1, 2, 3 point functions are pinned by conformal symmetry.
Okay.
But in general, if you look at multi-point correlation functions, you have to look at more general symmetries if you have other symmetries. And so you solve for the 4 point functions. Okay. So it could well be that there's various aspects in various models where actually, because of that different dependence of the 4 point functions, you might have to do more work to see this. Okay. So I don't know whether it's generically true. Okay. But again, it's the kind of question that you can start to ask. Right? And I think that's more generally the case, that, you know, are these genuinely effective temperatures that govern all observables, or are they observable and correlation function specific?
Okay. Now, we kind of see that the total density matrix cannot thermalize. she started out as a pure state, so somehow the thing says completely entangled. So somehow the non-thermal information has to be captured in high order correlators.
Well, that
I think we should go on to your main presentation.
Okay. So basically, I would say that, in relation to the main presentation, actually, is that, so I appreciate this is supposed to be non-equilibrium dynamics for ADS-CFT, and I will come on to that. However, I think what's vital, if you want to have an ADS-CMT correspondence, is you have to have a clear perspective on what are interesting questions in condensed matter physics. So simply computing correlation functions using ADS-CFT may ultimately, in the long run, be very profitable, but I think it needs to somehow be targeted appropriately in order to make contact with interesting results in condensed matter. Okay.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
Just in relation to the question about thermalism, there's a recent paper by Shrednicki and Riggle, and they are investigating the dependence on the initial state as well,
okay,
especially for these integrable systems. So there is, I forget exactly the conclusions, but you know, some initial, usually these are begun in the ground state and then quenched, but
ground state of the initial Hamiltonian.
The initial Hamiltonian, that's right. But they point out that it depends on your choice of initial state whether or not the resulting state thermalizes in whatever sense.
Absolutely, I completely agree. And some of these things also have practical issues, right? So a kind of quench type problem is say nuclear decoherence in a quantum dot, right? So you have some nucleus, you have some spin that you want to have your information stored in, but you've got this nuclear background, you prepare it in a given state, and the question is, how does the decoherence time depend on the configuration you start in, right? Can you tweak the nuclear polarization to influence this decay rate? So actually, initial conditions is very important. Let me give you a slightly different perspective on that. So very recently I was working on some problems with Jonathan Keeling and Ben Simons in a very different context, where they're placing ultra-cold atoms in an optical cavity, they hit them from the side, photons leak out, and they see a transition. Okay? But it's an open system, so you have to look at it dynamically. So there, what you can ask is about dynamical phase diagrams, in the sense that, what are the stable attractors of the long-time dynamics, irrespective of the initial conditions? So if you start in a given initial state, you will wind up in a particular final asymptotic state. Maybe it's not even a stationary state, it could have some residual time dependence. But you can start to somehow quantify this as to what is a phase diagram for a dynamical system. And so that's one of the points I want to get onto in relation to ADS-CFT, is whether or not it's actually possible to start teasing these things out of these examples. Okay.
Two comments.
Yeah.
I was also going to mention Mark Shrednicki's work. And my understanding is that there's a whole sort of scheme that they have of re-examining the whole question of how you approach thermalization in various systems, and there's a whole series of papers, I think.
Yeah, there's maybe eigenstate thermalization is the catchword for this.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying it might be worth, in case you didn't know about them.
No. So I completely agree. So there's a huge literature on quantum quenches, relations of thermalization in condensed matter physics. So I could spend all of my time doing condensed matter physics, right? But then it's not going to build any bridges between ADS-CFT. So here, I guess what I'm saying is that there's certain problems of a certain character that we're facing in condensed matter physics. There may be tools we can use in condensed matter physics that have got nothing to do with ADS-CFT, but somehow I'm trying to kind of have this mindset that I'm thinking of problems where actually ADS-CFT might have a complementary perspective and actually bring us to conclusions that are rather different and have a broader validity. So I completely agree, and it was just a bad choice of referencing on my...
Oh, no. I think it was just pointing information. I don't think...
No, sure. No,
yeah, but my second comment, and maybe you're going to talk about them, is that there now have been a number of very interesting higher dimensional results on quenching.
In ADS-CFT. Yeah, I'll come on to that in a minute. So maybe what I'll do is, I'll just flash the next transparency. This was just to demonstrate. This was recent results of Calabresi and Fabi Messler and company, where they've managed to derive exact asymptotics for the one-point function and the two-point functions for the transverse field Ising model. So you quench the magnetic field between two values within the ordered phase, and you can tease out some exact results. And their point is that, first of all, it's actually not difficult. It's hard to do this because you can fermionize this problem, but your spin operators are non-local with respect to these fermions. So you have to do some pretty serious gymnastics to tease these results out. Okay, but they bring quite a few different new perspectives. One then is this issue about thermalization. So they claim that in this problem, it's described by a generalized Gibbs ensemble, and roughly speaking, it's coming because you've got this integral over these independent K modes, which is giving rise to an effective temperature for each K mode. Okay.
Yeah. I agree with the generalized Gibbs ensemble, of course, but that's not thermalization. But I think we should.
No, it's not. It's not.
These philosophical issues, I think, not going to get us anywhere if you get to the actual calculations.
Well, actually, I'll give the talk in the way I think it's appropriate, actually.
Right.
So, again, it's a workshop and a discussion group on trying to build bridges between condensed matter physics and CFT. If you want to talk just on CFT, then there's no condensed matter physics, and I think it's pointless. Okay. So I'm sorry to kind of labour that point, and I tried to do it very strongly at the beginning, because I think it's actually important to do this. Okay. So again, you see, why is this important from a more general perspective? It's because nobody knows how to generalize these problems to other interacting field theories, right? They've done it for a special case, and so they've managed to shed some light on how you might extend this within the framework of 1 plus 1 integrability. And so, ADS-CFT might have some bearing here, okay? And as one of the comments came earlier, the main point of a lot of recent work on ADS-CFT is that people are looking at particular types of metric quenches. Okay, so you're interested in thermalization properties of gauge theories, and actually, you know, many people in the audience will know infinitely more about this than I do. And so it'd be interesting to know what are the most interesting questions from an ADS point of view. What are the easiest types of quenches to actually set up in ADS-CFT, and actually what kinds of observables is it straightforward to compute so that you can get some picture of what's going on in these kinds of problems that might actually be, that might resonate with condensed matter physicists, okay? And so there's a whole bunch on these so-called vidiometric quenches and evolution of entanglement entropy. And even in the last couple of weeks, whilst I've been at KITP, there's been people asking about quantum quenches across holographic critical points, and also evolution of two-point functions from holography. And so here, my understanding is that they're using some tricks from ADS-CFT that can be used put forward in this work, where you're trying to exploit some gravitational tricks in the limit of large scaling dimensions so that you can somehow replace a wave-like approach with some ray optics approach and actually replace complicated quantum problems by sums over geodesics. And so it's these kind of issues that you would have a hard time seeing in a condensed matter context that might have some natural way to get limiting behavior from ABS-CFT. And I think the other issue as well is that obviously looking at normal modes of these black hole solutions has bearings on the long time asymptotics. Okay, so actually let me just view the time. I'll skip over the experimental motivation and talk about the BCS quench dynamics. Okay. So what I want to talk about then is, so this is some
the typical non-equilibrium problems addressed right now by the holographic people might not have a direct relation to the questions you would like to ask in condensed matter physics, or is it better than that?
Sorry, you say they might not.
All these problems that are right now addressed with ADS-CFT. My question is a simple one: do they have somehow already a relation with problems that we
For example, in this recent paper here, okay, they were precisely trying to make contact with the results of Cardi-Calabresi, starting from an ADS perspective. Okay. okay? And there may be others, okay? So what I'm saying is actually part of the difficulty is that as a condensed matter physicist, I want to see these points of contact and to be able to try and generalize them. But obviously, many of these results are buried in the specific examples that are being considered. And so it's very difficult to tease out some more general overarching picture. And so I think precisely this is why these kind of problems actually offer an opportunity to do that.
Okay. Can I give my picture? I think CFD2s are not normalized. They are integrable, all of them, and there's no effect of temperature at this point. They are wrong. Okay. They have some strange correlation functions, decay exponents, but they don't. The CFD3s are much more generic and higher. Mm-hmm. They do thermalize, and so in fact, ABS CFD is in fact giving a generic answer, mm-hmm. which none of the integrable system studies so far are really not describing anything realistic.
But I think I have precisely the same picture. I mean, so I said very clearly at the beginning, I mean, it's nice to make these contacts between 1 plus 1D, primarily because you can actually then help condensed matter physicists understand what's going on. Okay, that's one reason to do it. Second, you might shed light on some of these more subtle issues that are associated with 1 plus 1. That's the second reason. The third is that you can generalize them to higher dimensions, and as you said, you might then expect generic features of integrability, but of non-integrability. But then the point is that actually, you know, condensed matter physicists have to have some feeling for whether or not these models are similar to models that they would consider generically in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And as I said, one issue is that if these things thermalize incredibly rapidly, you might worry that they're strange animals, okay, or stranger than we would normally meet in condensed matter physics. Maybe it's an artifact of the large N limit, okay? Maybe not.
No, I think near quantum critical points, if you have a non-integrable CFD in higher dimensions, the thermalization time is h bar over kT, even in generic condensed matter systems. So, in fact, the example you mentioned is far away from a critical point.
Okay, but that's fine. But also, some of the examples I would consider in a moment. I mean, we can also look at dynamics in a holographic superconductor, in the ordered phase, okay? So one of the things that I didn't mention was actually the results of Fabian Essler and collaborators are all done for quenches in the ordered phase. And it actually turns out to be difficult to ask questions about what happens if you go through the transition, what happens if you do quenches just purely in the paramagnetic phase.
There's a problem with the theory of the holographic superconductor per se, because that has all kinds of gapless modes that realistic superconductors don't have. But that's not a problem with the whole method. Okay, go on.
What do you mean with the whole method? Sorry, I didn't understand that.
If you take the theory of the holographic superconductor seriously, they always have in the low energy limit some Lipschitz or ADS metric, which means there's all kinds of low energy gapless modes in the theory of holographic superconductor that don't exist in real superconductors.
Absolutely.
And I'm sure that's playing a role in all the non-equilibrium dynamics you might study by the method.
Absolutely, but then that's precisely my point, you see. So the question is as follows. What problems can you use ADS-CFT for and get interesting, reliable results? Now, if I took your statement accurately, you would say there's not a hope in hell's chance of using any of these ADS-CFT examples to look at a non-equilibrium problem because they have low-energy modes that are not shared by condensed matter physicists.
If you take a realistic quantum critical point like the one you mentioned, it gets everything right.
Okay, so again, I mean, part of this kind of exercise and why it's a discussion is to try and actually delimit what types of problems you can look at and hope to answer, and what are the actual additional features that arise because you've got some large N theory and there's additional sectors. So I completely agree. Yeah?
Can I ask you a question? So Subir, can I translate the first thing you said holographically? Is that than saying that there's no way to form a black hole in ADS-3?
That's not true.
Okay, they may be artifacts of a large N limit there, but if I take the CFT, as given, as defined to finite N,
okay,
and then apply various component mapping methods, I don't get thermalization. I mean, I know that the current correlation function has a delta function. Uh-huh. At all, exactly. It's an exact property of the CFT2. Because you could this is a closed equilibrium anyway. But in CFT3, you can't do that. You can't just from a zero temperature correlation know what the finite temperature correlations are.
That gets me to curiosity question, right? So you know how it works in the CFT, and now you go to ADS3, right?
Yeah.
And you say there's no real civilization, and then your question is a nice one. Does it mean that in ADS3 you cannot form or rhizomes.
Well, I mean, you can also take larger limits of massive theories of two dimensions, and those, not this one, and those are done by the
principle. Yeah. On the gravitational side, what is
the... Larger gate series that have these three dimensions are not capitals, actually.
Yeah.
So they may apply in those cases.
But how does it work on the gravitational side? So just curiosity question.
You can call black holes in area 3.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm saying, but it probably due to some massive gate theory, not strictly the point at hand, it can't be.
You're not just talking about rational theories where the symmetries are make it virtually interrelated. It's much more general than that. I mean, because there's a lot of discussion of CFTs which are basically integrable, they're rational.
Okay.
And then there are CFTs which have many, many more degrees of freedom than they have symmetries. They're not rational at all. And the latter you would think would thermalize, but maybe they have decoupled non-thermalizing sectors because of the symmetry or something. I don't know what.
Yeah, can you prove this just using Virasoro or do you need an order algorithm?
Well, okay, so you can certainly for any of the CFTs, once I have power of correlation at zero temperature, I can get them at one temperature by conformal mapping. Okay, and many of them, those don't obey any of the principle of hydrodynamics or any of that nice system. That's the basis of my statement.
You don't need a big higher algebra, you just need Virasoro.
You just need the conformal mapping of plane to the solid.
But the absence of dynamic doesn't necessarily imply the absence of thermalization.
Okay, well, depends how you define
it.
Okay,
beautiful. Yeah, no, but it's fine. It's a discussion, right? I mean, it's supposed to be a discussion, right? I mean, so that's how it's been advertised.
Then it will completely flesh out how holography works for these special two-dimensional CFT problems. It's still in the cool section.
The stress tensor doesn't thermalize, but I see. That's true.
Yeah.
For example, you can't form black holes in ES3s because the boundary graviton is permanently forever decoupled and the bulk black hole doesn't fall in, just propagates along. So there's a secondary theory that does decouple, but you can't see in the most obvious coordinates.
If the energy doesn't thermalize, then that's not thermalization.
It's
got all kinds of strange conservation laws, but that's not very...
Well, this appears to be a system. Can we just separate off boundary graviton and talk about?
Can just collide two massive particles?
Can we do this cleanly in the vault and talk about a conserved energy in the vault that doesn't include boundary gravitons? Roughly speaking, there's a sector that just decouples, doesn't thermalize, and there's a large sector that does thermalize.
Yes. Yeah.
So maybe that's a useful perspective. I'm not sure we can make that completely precise.
Well, okay. What I would say, you put even an infinitesimal perturbation away from your exact solution. So the final solution changes completely. Whereas for non-reversible systems like CFT3, the solution you get from the CFT is generic. It moves slightly away, but small perturbation, hardly anything will change.
You're saying what happens that one little decoupled sector would now also fall into the black hole?
There's a few generic perturbation in the system. You have a little piece of it from
You define the system as your beautiful conformal field theory. I say, okay, put some of that and move away from conformal symmetry in the ultraviolet just a little bit.
Yeah.
Which is going to violate your beautiful conservation law. Mm-hmm. You'll completely change the long time limit.
I see, you make it non-conformal.
Well, on the ultraviolet, not really.
Yeah.
I read all kinds of irrelevant perturbations. If you haven't really thermalized to a true thermal state, all kinds of irrelevant perturbation would totally change your long time limit.
So you're saying thermalization is a property of the neighborhood of your...
Well, that's, I think, a reasonable definition of thermalization in an experimental physicist sense. There's some generic behavior in long time limits.
But what's interesting is, in this ADS3 example, while I agree with you, that the nature of thermalization changes.
Yeah.
When you have conformal symmetry, there'll be this sort of decoupled piece that doesn't thermalize.
Mm-hmm.
What I think happens, if you break conformal symmetry by, for example, moving the boundary inward to a finite place,
right,
is you'll find that now everything does thermalize in a way that looks a lot like the sector of the original conformal field theory that did thermalize. The BTC black hole is going to the same dynamics. If you move the boundary inward, you still have the boundary graviton, but now it interacts with the black hole, and so now it should thermalize. So I actually think that in this example, you can see what's going to happen in the more generic case, even though I agree.
Okay, hold on. So you're saying that you have examples where you, in a conformal field theory, you have a non-equilibrium in the dual picture, you get a BTC black hole emerging as you evolve in time.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sorry, in the spirit of discussion, could I expand, ask you to expand on one of your comments from one dimension higher?
Yeah.
Which was about the fact, because of the, you know, the low temperature sector of the holographic superconductor has, you know, all of these states that...
Oh, yeah, that.
Right.
Yeah.
So in what way do they sort of interfere? Well, is there a sense in which one could study some non-equilibrium dynamics and sort of keep those sort of safely out, or do they interfere in a way that there's no tunable parameter? I'm just trying to get a sense of...
Well, I mean, if you use the ABS safety perspective, you know, the whole equation that Einstein equation you're writing down knows everything about those models. I don't know how you can separate them out. That's what you're studying. I mean, you would have to take these confining geometries or something and then study those.
I just wonder whether there's some class of questions for which you can sort of keep them safely at arm's length.
Maybe.
As soon as you go non-equilibrium, you're saying that's not...
Okay. I don't know. Maybe.
But that's
something about the standard theory of the holographic superconductor that, you know, I think needs more attention.
Sure. It just sounded like what you were saying, given that they existed, it sort of, you know, sort of kills that whole...
It's fine, because I mean, I can skip various things and still say the key points I want to make. So what I just wanted to point out was that, so then on the basis of, you know, lots of interesting experiments in cold atoms, people started to then think seriously about what would happen if you turn on pairing interactions in the BCS Hamiltonian. And it turns out that actually this problem can be solved exactly, and so it was done by Barankov, Levitov, and Spivak. And let me skip over, well, actually, let me not skip over this. I mean, basically what they started out doing is they said, look, I want to know what's the time dependence of the order parameter if I, say, start from a normal state and then quickly turn on pairing, okay? And what they find is that they can derive an effective equation for this gap parameter, and they see oscillations, okay? And on the next transparency, they go a bit further on a later paper. There was also some work by Emil Justbashire, who's done quite a lot of work on this, so I should also add him to the list of references here in collaboration with Boris Altshuler. But the basic point is that you can obtain a phase diagram for this quench problem. Okay, so what they're plotting here is the initial pairing gap. So you imagine you've got some interaction parameter that gives you a certain equilibrium gap, and you quench to a different gap abruptly, okay? And so then what they say is that actually what happens in this problem is that to the left of this region, okay, they have collective oscillations where the amplitude of the gap oscillates indefinitely. In this region, they have a different behavior where there's damped oscillations, and the long-time asymptotics is that there's some effective gap that's given by this blue curve. And over here, you have extinguished the asymptotic gap, okay? So a very simple way to just think about this is that here, what you're saying is you've quenched to a state where your final gap is very small, okay? It says you're trying to kill superconductivity here, okay? And so another way to say this is that your quench is so violent that you've put so much energy into this system that your effective temperature is above the equilibrium transition temperature for the final gap parameter, so it disappears. In this region, you see these oscillations. You're starting from a normal state, you're turning on superconductivity, so it's a nonlinear system. It develops superconductivity and then relaxes back and it oscillates, okay? And in this integrable case, it would carry on indefinitely, okay? But what they argue is that in a generic situation where you've got some energy relaxation in this problem, that actually there's some final asymptotic gap and some final effective temperature.
If you remember correctly, right, that the oscillations are not quantum oscillations or radar oscillations, but it's just in the classical time evolution effectively of the order parameter.
Well, so there's a few things there. So it's classical in the sense that, you know, this kind of BCS type Hamiltonian is kind of has a mean field character in the sense that everybody is interacting with everybody else. And so one of the points of Emil Justbashire and Boris Altshuler was that the integrability that governs what happens in the thermodynamic limit is classical integrability. Okay. In connection with Rabi oscillations, there's actually one that you see, their title involved this, okay, so I have to comment on this. Their basic point was that if you look at the BCS problem in an Anderson pseudo-spin representation, so replace these bilinears by spin, it's an effective spin problem. This spin executes a 2π rotation on the Bloch sphere in the same period of these oscillations. So what they claim is there's a similar phenomenon to what happens in electromagnetically induced transparency, where you've got some wave propagating through a medium. It's exciting some resonant transition. But if that oscillation, that Rabi oscillation, is of the same period as the wave propagation, then the problem collectively reinforces and you have transparency. And so they say there's actually a formal similarity between those problems. Okay? But here I just want to point out, there is a phase diagram. Okay, it's a dynamical phase diagram as a result of this quench. And in particular, by this kind of Anderson pseudo-spin representation, they can analyze the oscillations and they can see, for example, that over in this exponentially decaying regime where you kill the gap, there's a particular time dependence and a particular dependence on the gap. And to the left of that regime where you have damped oscillations, they can tease those things out. Okay. And so what we want to do is to try and ask such things for holographic superconductors. So just to also come back, I mean, this was in relation to what happens at finite end. So you asked about classical integrability. This is some recent work of Jean-Sébastien Cole trying to put beta ansatz in a position so that you can look at time-dependent dynamical problems, okay? And so they get a good agreement with what happens in this Barankov-Levitov scenario. So I'll skip over the details of that. Okay. So then in relation to a holographic superconductor, holographic superconductor, you're coupling this Abelian-Higgs model, so it's some model of some charge scalar field coupled to gravity. And in equilibrium, below this critical temperature, you have some black hole with some scalar hair corresponding to spontaneous U1 symmetry breaking in the boundary theory. And actually, people have started to ask what would happen if you looked at non-equilibrium properties of these superconductors. Because if you start in one of these black hole solutions that corresponds not to the superconducting state, but the Reisner-Nordström state above TC, then you're effectively starting in an unstable equilibrium. Okay, and so it's like starting in a supercooled phase and asking how do you time evolve to a superconducting phase. And so there, in order to analyze the dynamics, you have to give this a nudge. Okay, so in the quench problems I said at the beginning, you're automatically starting out not in an eigenstate of the system. Here you're accidentally starting out in an eigenstate of the system, but it's unstable. Okay. So what do they do? They say, well, okay, let's have, let's have a look at this scalar field. This is the guy we want to track. And we need to give it a nudge, okay? So this is very much in the spirit of these kind of metric perturbations. They're applying some Gaussian perturbation to this initial state and asking how does it propagate then as a function of time given this initial condition, okay? And so what they find is that they can track the time evolution of this order parameter. Okay, so you can read off from this boundary correspondence what the order parameter is in the boundary theory, and so that they see that if you start above TC, then you relax to the normal state with some characteristic relaxation rate. But if you're below TC, you approach the superconducting state. And these time-dependent rates you can get by looking at quasi-normal modes of these black hole solutions. Okay, so they're impacting on long-time dynamics. Okay. So then here, I mean, there's already been some clear questions. So first of all, I don't see any oscillations in this. Okay, so maybe it's because these are very strongly damped. Maybe actually these modes that Subir was talking about in this holographic superconductor are coupling to this. Maybe they act as some kind of that. Okay, so maybe it's a question of, sorry?
The relaxational time scale is H by divided by KVT.
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, it's an interesting question, actually. I mean, so... Well, I don't think so, because, I mean, here it's not quite the same. I mean, Subir was talking about relaxation rates at a critical point. And so here you're talking about quenching between, say, a normal phase and an ordered phase, or some two distant points in the superconductor. So I don't actually know how to think qualitatively about those time scales. Okay.
Well, I mean, you started on a right-hand launch on black hole. That's surely at all kinds of modes there.
Yeah.
That's even farther away from the real superconductor.
But this is precisely the kind of question, right? So are the dynamics of holographic superconductors related to condensed matter systems, or intrinsically different? And maybe they're just intrinsically different, okay? But then you might ask, as somebody asked before, is it possible to somehow decouple these sectors so that you can ask about time-dependent problems? I mean, the reason I'm kind of looking at these time-dependent problems is just because if you look at what that kind of duality relation could potentially be useful for, it is time-dependent problems. But if there's an obstacle immediately because of the character of these problems that actually, you know, you have to use it with some caution, well, okay, that's just the way it is, right? So,
at least in the equilibrium, there's yet another time scale, which is h bar t minus tc, right, which is associated with the order problem fluctuation of all stages of the transition.
Well, okay, so in the quench problem, I mean, exactly, I mean, you've got to compare the various rates in your problem, and so they made a comment as to which regime...
You would think that there should be sort of a universal time there.
Well, so, okay, so, I mean, it's a question of energy scale hierarchies, okay, for a quench problem.
We went from well above TC to well below TC, so the critical dynamics of TC doesn't really come in there, I think. If they went close to TC, I suspect that one will get some aspect of that from ADCFT, and I think people have looked at that.
So,
well, okay, so then, you know, you can ask about what is the role of finite temperature in terms of damping oscillations. I mean, the initial calculations of Levitov and company were all at T equals zero, and then you're asking about equilibration aspects separately. And so one of the things we're trying to do is actually what happens if you do the quenches between two superconducting solutions, i.e. in the spirit of Barankov and Levitov, okay? And so this is just some kind of initial numerical results for trying to set these kind of problems up, where you can look at, say, some ABS4/CFT3. You know that the gauge fields are dual to some currents, and so you could think about quenching the zeroth component of this to act like a chemical potential quench, for example, in the boundary CFT. And so you can solve a coupled Einstein equations in that problem, and you see that you have oscillations propagating into the interior of ADS, but we've got to do some more legwork to see what is the corresponding time evolution of the boundary order parameter, because that you get by taking an expansion of this guy close to the boundary and trying to read it off. Okay, so the general program is in place, and so then, you know, we're just trying to push this forward to see what can be done and what kind of information you can get out of these dynamical problems. But I think, you know, the real interest is, can you kind of extend these to higher dimensional systems? Can you understand aspects of equilibration in these problems and push this forward as an approach to non-equilibrium dynamics?
There's plenty of time for discussion. More
discussion. I was just saying that the Levitov calculation problem, you need to specify it a bit and just check this, the observation.
So they did. They did it in the sense that they phenomenologically added damping. So you see, you've got some effective block dynamics when you cast it as an Anderson pseudo spin problem, and then they phenomenologically included some kind of damping to ask what happens if you were at finite temperature. But
how is damping dependent on temperature?
Well, I guess, but you see here, it's just put in by hand, gamma equals 0.01, to simulate the effects, to see how stable might these things be to temperature variation. But if you said, can you do the computation? I mean, you might be able to do the computation given that it's integrable. But you're asking, can you look at integrable dynamics at finite temperature? Well, good luck, right? I mean, you know, maybe. So, again, you know, some of these questions might be more readily generalizable. Okay.
Yeah. I missed. So, when you had a slide saying where are the oscillations in which model were you asking?
No. So here I just said, so in the BCS case, I mean, if you start from a normal state and go to a superconductor.
Oh, no, okay. Before that.
No. If you start here, right, this is starting from a normal state going to a superconductor. And I should add that actually I think the character of this regime is because it's actually in some sense collisionless dynamics. So this has the interpretation of a regime where you're dephasing your individual Cooper pair states because they're coupling to a collective mode. So this is like Landau damping. And so here, though, you've got some nonlinear oscillations because you start in a normal state, you quench it to a superconductor, so you go superconducting, but it's a highly nonlinear system and it gets dropped back and it oscillates, okay? And it carries on oscillating up until there's a point where actually the coupling becomes so strong that they dephase, okay? So all I was saying is that just in this kind of nonlinear type of setup, right, I mean, here is a quench from a normal state to a point above TC, you have one spike, and then that's it. Okay, so there's no.
I get that, but yeah. What's the intuition behind not seeing oscillations?
They might be just damped out. I mean, it's a very strongly interacting.
I get it right. That the oscillation really tied to the fact that the order ground is highly mean field. So I guess it's not generic.
Well, in the sense that it's integrable, that they're solving.
Yeah, no, but it's basically like in this pseudo-spin representation, basically all pseudo-spins talk is all pseudo-spins.
Yeah, I mean,
so that's the mean field.
In that sense, it's mean.
And that makes the dynamics actually rather less logical in a way.
Right, but here you're asking about dynamics in a large N theory. So is large N mean field?
Large N is getting the same sense of mean field control. I think that's the issue you're asking.
Well, you know, there's
it's very ungeneric for a normal placement system because mean field is very rare.
Good. I mean, there's the field theory tracking of where the oscillations, their ultimate fate. But it seems to me that things like that should be extremely natural to address from the geometric perspective. Even some sense.
No,
it's cleaner. So I'm just puzzled as to why one.
Well, I would say that actually, I mean, you're asking about quasi-normal modes in these systems, and I'm not sufficiently expert to give you an authoritative discussion of the quasi-normal modes of black holes, okay? But my understanding is that actually it's complicated business because you've got to take into account back reaction of the metric and look at all the fluctuations.
So that's where I was going at. I was just trying to understand more about their calculation to see why they don't see.
Yeah, well, this is somehow what we're trying to do. So Julian Sommer at this moment is actually trying to look at the collective dynamics around these charged black holes to get a feeling for the collective oscillations. And naturally, you would expect both a real and an imaginary contribution, generically.
So is the answer that they were completely in the probe limit? Is that really what?
I've no idea.
No. It's fullback reactive. It's a time evolution fullback reactive.
And it's fully back reactive?
It's completely back.
And they don't see oscillation?
They don't see any oscillations. I think this might be related to the fact that they start with a perturbation that only excites the mode that is unstable. And so
that may be.
Yeah, and so you actually have no quasi normal modes. Okay. So they only excite the one that will give the instability in a certain way. I think this is.
Because generically, I would have thought it would be the other way around. You'd have oscillations, and then you would know what to do with these, not seeing
them. You will be unbalanced because the locals are starting to meet these oscillations.
Right.
But the problem is that to do those modes at the full nonlinear level, you cannot use this because this is a 1 plus 1 system, and these modes would require a 2 plus 1 system. Or a 3 plus 1.
But 1 plus 1 in the sense that it's not depending on space.
Oh, right? I see.
So, yeah, so you've got time on the boundary.
I see. It's only S-wave.
And
okay.
To excite the other ones at the full nonlinear level, you need coordinate that is fully nonlinear, and that's so far.
But the
kinetic
calculation, it is the Q equals 0 mode that's oscillating.
Only the Q equals 0 mode, so there's no other modes.
The approximation is solved, but that's the only one they keep, in fact.
But it's fully back reactive,
that
I can tell you.
Okay, thanks.
So can you simulate this thing you have in ADS-CFT, this kick, just in the BCSC? I mean, so the argument is that you start with very different initial conditions, right?
Well,
so why not try to mimic the initial conditions ADS-CFT?
Well, but then, I mean, okay, so then, that's a separate question, right?
Yeah,
so there's a kind of back and forth here, right? So in the BCS case, it was natural to quench the pairing interaction, okay? So in the ADS case, you've got to say, what is it natural to quench, okay? So the first thing we looked at is chemical potential quenches. But then you could ask the same question. If you do a chemical potential quench in a VCS superconductor, what happens? And I think actually, morally speaking, it must wind up at the same story because you will have a relationship between chemical potential and the gap. So you're going to morph the phase diagram in some way.
Yeah, but so there must let's go to VCS. And now we say we compute the state in the presence of a interaction, right? Corresponding with a super cold liquid of ADS. And I have a hard time sort of imagining how I should.
Sorry, I missed how I join ADS.
Yeah, so the PCS, issue is sorry. There are two different calculations going on related to a difference in this condition. So in the BCS case, you do the no brainer thing, you don't start out with a non interacting system, and then you switch on suddenly the interactive interaction, and there it goes. In ADS, you have just that system. That is interacting all the time, and you take a metastable state.
In that particular example?
Yeah, and now I'll ask the question, why not do that particular example using the BCSC?
Because then I would be doing condensed matter physics inspired by ADS.
And so which is fine.
But here the question was more, you know, is it possible to ask some interesting questions about ADS and push
no,
that?
No, I don't agree. I mean, so, but I don't agree. It's about trying to figure out what the generic features are.
And
now there's sort of a claim that because these initial conditions are very, very different, we see a very different dynamics. So I ask immediately, like, when you would take these initial conditions in your silly ECS calculation, would you actually find the same kind of non-equilibrium dynamics as you find in ADS CFT?
Well, I think in principle these things can be analysed in the sense that it's integrable and it's solvable, right? So, but off the top of my head, if you say, what happens if you start in an unstable eigenstate at your initial condition? What happens to the time evolution?
We I don't know
off the top of my head, right? But it's something that probably can be done. It's just that the reason that I didn't do any of this is that, you know, a lot of people have looked at a lot of aspects of the BCS dynamics, and really I was just trying to use these as some kind of fuel to try and start to ask questions in the ADS. I understand, but you know, I'm not even sure, you know, maybe the oscillations are incredibly damped out. So I think my feeling is, at the moment, I'll kind of press on the ADS side and just see what happens, right? Because I just want to know what happens. And then there'll be an interpretational problem for what's coming out, okay? But, you know, you could spend quite a lot of time trying to look at this on the BCS side and still not make contact, right? Just because they might be intrinsically different.
Why do people expect there to be oscillations in the first place? Like there's no theorem that says once you go, you know, below the transition, there must be oscillations.
In which example?
In any example, like there are oscillations in the BCS model.
Right.
But why are there supposed to be oscillations?
No, there's no proof and there's no. Yeah. So all I'm saying is that, okay, here's a kind of this is a quantitative phase diagram you get out of BCS, and it may be that those aspects are rooted in the fact that it's collisionless. But if you just asked, if you took a nonlinear system and whacked it, what's going to happen? In general, you can set up oscillations. And so all I'm saying is when you look at that example, you don't see much in the way of oscillations. And so there's just a question, where are they? Maybe they're not there for some very good reason, and maybe it's rooted into the dynamics of ADS or other modes, et cetera, et cetera. So I wouldn't say that this is a kind of rigorous proof. It's not. I mean, it's just a question that we're asking. Can we try and get some feel for what the resulting time-dependent dynamics in such a quench? And then you would have to ask, is this generic to all quenches? Are you really probing something about, you know, these intrinsic dynamics that is kind of universal to all quenches, or do you have to kind of treat them all on a separate footing?
Are there any kind of rigorous results that I'm very ignorant about this, but saying are there rigorous results that says, you know, if you start from such and such state with such and such interactions
in BCS?
Then it's not weakly coupled eventually, we know, so then it's a debatable point there. But 3 plus 1, you do expect oscillations if you quench across the critical point. So, I don't know. And this is always the strongly coupled, so it's a very different limit. Yes, and somewhere in between, they have to disappear.
But what's the same with the oscillations? I mean, final state is some kind of black hole.
Right, but I was just meaning, I mean, this is the, I just mean, this is the time evolution, as I understand it, of this particular quench, right?
If you can work backwards from the black hole, there's something quasi alone.
No, but that's what we're trying to do.
Exactly,
right. Exactly. But that's precisely what we're trying to do. So there must be, right? But then there's a question of is there a phase diagram for this problem, right?
I think the last question we're talking about are zero momentum. So here's your black brain, and think of you've got this boson condensate.
Yeah.
You're thinking of the amplitude of that boson condensate oscillation.
Oh, that's a particular kind of oscillation.
It's the oscillation of the amplitude of the boson condensate.
The condensate is
the Higgs boson.
No, but it is the scalar pair of the black hole, and so you would expect there to be some communication between the generic oscillations, the relativist, like Don would see, and that scalar sector. So to me, the question is more the other way around, but anyway.
This is a silly question, but the quasi-normal modes, if you're well away from the critical point, if you have TC 1.1, 0.8, then the imaginary part of these lightest quasi-normal modes that would support the inverse temperature in these systems, right? So why is it that simple? You have to go very, very close to the critical point where these quasi-normal modes are parametrically light and then you can see oscillations. Does this make sense? I mean, these pictures that you show without oscillations, I'm wondering if the reason why you're not seeing oscillations could be this.
In these examples,
yes.
The oscillations you're looking for have time scales that are longer than the thermal time scale.
If you're very, very close to a transition, then you have a slight mode.
Which decays slowly.
I'm saying that the most simple question you can ask is look at the zero temperature, right?
There's always
a simple thing, and
that's
good phase decision. Zero temperature decision is very close to it.
No, I mean that's precisely what we're doing.
So
set it up at zero temperature.
Very hard. Why isn't that done?
Well, because it takes some effort. I mean, so first of all, you've got to solve these coupled Einstein equations.
Oh, you're doing it, actually.
No, that's what Toby Wiseman's doing. I mean, Toby's an expert in solving these partial differential equations. But actually, it's rather difficult to solve these things, right? So you've got to extrapolate them for long times and get everything right in terms of the boundary conditions. And so it's not tricky to tease these things out, okay? So, yeah. Okay. No, but that's fine. So Julian's trying to look at the quasi-normal modes in this and try and... It's ultimately related to what we would see in the full time evolution of this problem. I mean, that's another aspect of this, right? I mean, you can track the full time evolution, and in principle, the long time asymptotic should be related to features of the black hole dynamics. And so it's just interesting to see how those morph together and whether or not you can learn something, whether or not there are simpler questions you can go after. I mean, maybe, you know, the holographic superconductor might not be the best place to look at these kind of problems, right? So, I'm not wedded to any of these specific examples or specific quenches, right? I mean, it's just more of a general statement that the setup of ADS-CFT is sufficiently powerful to enable you to look at time-dependent correlation functions, and the only question is which are the most sensible problems to tackle first.
I have a general question about non-equilibrium stuff. Is it possible that some non-equilibrium probe would be very sensitive to the dynamical critical exponent if you have a sector with, say, a non-trivial Z? Has this been studied either in condensed matter or in
I'm not sure, actually. I don't know.
That's a hard thing to measure, as far as I understand.
So the dynamical critical exponent.
Yeah.
I mean, experimentally, or
yeah.
Well, I mean, you could imagine all sorts of quench protocols that try and probe your system. Okay. So a very kind of pedestrian way in which this probes the system is that, you know, if you've got this type of, I mean, forget the oscillation issue, right? I mean, very crudely speaking, what this is saying is that if you hit this sample very, very hard, right, over here it's a normal phase, over here it's still superconducting. So in a sense, you're probing the finite temperature phase diagram by kicking the system, right? So could you, in principle, look at things associated with critical behavior and other things from a quench perspective? Maybe, right? But I don't know, right? I mean, I'd have to think about it more carefully. Right? So I don't know on the condensed matter side if people have looked at such things.
Back to the ATS perspective, but there's one limit. Almost guaranteed to be a loss of basin, which is just for some reason, if you take your radial direction and just cut it off at some very short arc, then you just bring that against both here.
Here.
Geometry just terminates for some reason. Then you just bring that against both here, you will get oscillations. So now you've got to really treat the infrared a little more carefully.
But I think that's part of the issue that Toby runs into with the numerics is how to kind of treat the singularities and black holes in ADS space and also in the long time limit. Okay, so you know I'm not sufficiently honed up on all the various technical issues of the numerical solution. But yeah, I mean it could well be that actually one thing you can do is impose some
problem approximation where people first study low rapid superconductors. The same effect is just kind of infrared theory. It's not back to the Akiyama metric. Mm-hmm. So the bulk calculation is what he was saying by the core theory. How can you not get
but you have non-trivial boundary conditions in the infrared.
You have gradients.
Yeah. So the quasi, if you just ask about the quasi-normal mode spectrum, if you cut off ADS, you're going to have something with appreciable real parts of the quasi.
Well, but they're really just asking about the mode of phi itself. So we'll use a few minutes. Mm-hmm.
The ideal kind of things like to see is that if you start from generic state, you see a few oscillations, and then it equilibrates at some finite temperature T. And all correlations are given by the Gibbs ensemble.
Right.
That's what you want. And I think it's reasonable.